Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 5th, 2009. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, mead maker Mike Lozano joins us to walk us through an easy way to make pyments using wine kits. Also, we get a 100% positive homebrew legislation update. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter, my username, Basic Brewing, all one word. You can also find me on Facebook. My username there is Basic Brewing James, Basic Brewing again, being all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook. If you become a fan of the show there, I'll be sending out occasional notices when shows are posted, such as that. And you can find good stuff there, like the recipe for the bread pudding that Steve made on the latest Basic Brewing Video episode. Our 2009 Brewers Logbooks, still in stock. You can check them out on our online store at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our Basic Brewing site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. We've got a lot to go through today, so let's get to it. Nothing but good news this week in our homebrew legislation update. First off, Mark Emily from Washington State reports that the bill relaxing restrictions on transporting homebrew has passed the state Senate unanimously. On to the House. Congratulations, everybody. Keep up the support. You can go to wahomebrewers.org/legal for more information. That's wahomebrewers.org/legal for more information on how you can keep up that support for the bill up there in Washington State. But the big news this week is from Utah, where the bill to legalize home brewing there has passed both the Senate and the House. For more on that, let's go out to the man who started the ball rolling, Douglas Warzynski. Well, Douglas Warzynski, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
James Spencer, it is always a pleasure to be a part of your podcast.
Well, and you know, from now on, we're going to have to find an excuse to have you come back because you've succeeded in your efforts. And, you know, now I've got no ready excuse to have Douglas Warzynski back on the show since
is always May 12th.
Oh, well, that's true. That is true. So you are, and as I told you in an email, I think, I don't think that you should have to pay for a beer in the state of Utah ever again. That's just my opinion. Have you seen any repercussions from the success of the passing of the legislation?
Well, I think that the people at the Beer Nut have always treated me well, and being a part of a successful legislative change kind of gives you a little street cred at law school. But other than that, I think that particularly this year, the project took on such a life of its own that it belongs to no one person. So the change of the law in Utah definitely belongs to all homebrewers because they really did affect change this year. So I'm happy to take credit from whoever's willing to give it to me, but in the end, you know, I was just a kid that wrote the first email to my representative, and after that, I just tried to help people get information whenever they needed it.
So you're not even out of law school, and already you're sounding like a politician. So, so for those who may be just joining us in this conversation, or may have forgotten how this all started, give us a brief recap of. The whole story from the beginning.
All right. I can do that. So really, it all kind of started when I was homebrewing in Utah, and I started law school, and I met up with a couple other brewers in law school, and I guess I was talking about it in sort of boisterous terms, and someone shushed me. And I said, well, what's that about? And they said, well, it's probably not entirely legal in this state. And so I did a little research. First stop was beertown.org and got in touch with Gary Glass just sort of haphazardly. I'd never communicated with him before. And he confirmed that his impression was that it wasn't legal. And feverishly that night, you know, just sort of feeling the power of maybe a couple semesters of law school under my belt. And I felt like I could write some sort of memo. And I wrote that to my representative. And sure enough, she touched base with the Beer Nut that year and said, you know, would you guys be willing to support that? And and they were on board. And so last year, they introduced the bill sort of halfway through the session. And for those not familiar with the way Utah runs their legislative sessions, they only run an abbreviated one. It's about 40 days every year at the beginning of every year. And so anytime you want to start legislation, the sooner in the session, the better, because there's very little time to get it done. And in fact, we'd started about midstream last year, and we made some great progress, significantly so over the previous attempt, which was perhaps 11 years earlier, where it died in committee. And it passed the House last year, and it eventually just expired in the Senate. And Representative Johnson, the bill's sponsor, was happy to start it up again this year, and she did. And we got the ball rolling well before the session even started in some interim committee meetings. And actually having a dry run last year worked for us in a number of ways, because this year we had all the communication channels set up and email distribution lists. And so that's what I mean when I say people were really involved this year, and Utah homebrewers really owned this victory, is because every step of the way, you know, in various committee meetings, we would see time and time again that representatives and senators were surprised at just how many emails they would get from homebrewers and how many homebrewers were in their various districts. And I think that, combined with the really powerful testimony that homebrewers and of course Gary Glass and Mark Alston, the owner of the Beer Nut, as they provided in person at these various committee meetings, really had a fundamental role in educating people, changing minds, and really is why this bill passed.
So last week was kind of a nail biter, in kind of a cluster, you know what, in a way. But I guess it's fairly typical in legislation. Give us kind of a look at what happened last week.
All right. So last week, we actually saw that the Senate added an amendment to the bill when they had it after the House already passed the original language. And when that amendment was added and approved on, it was now, you know, different from between the two chambers. And so it had to go back to the House for a vote. And what I think surprised a lot of homebrewers when you listen to the floor debates was that our own representative, Representative Johnson, moved that the House reject the bill with the amended language and send it back to the Senate. And that was, you know, a big gasp moment, because it kind of caught some people off guard, myself included. And really, I think that was, in the end, a very good thing. And it was a nail biter. And I think that's the advantage of having a professional legislator on your side, because, you know, she was in a position to dispassionately analyze the situation, and if not for her, you know, we wouldn't have the nicely drafted language that we have right now. Now, there are limitations, and that's what the amendment was all about how much can be transported at any given time. But the original wording was overly restrictive, it was extremely confusing, and almost arbitrary. And I think that even a lot of homebrewers, when they saw that amendment go in place, would have rather it not be there. But you know, when the session's starting to come to a close, you think to yourself, you know, well, all right, fine. If I have to compromise and accept this language, at least we can brew. And, you know, and that's what we're really all about. And I think that a lot of people were willing to leave well enough alone. But Robert Johnson stepped in and really took things by the reins. And what happens when, you know, the two chambers can't agree on differing language that they passed, this concept of a conference committee is triggered. And three representatives and three senators come together, and they do like this joint committee report where they hammer out the language, and then it has to go back to each chamber for a vote. And that procedure, you know, it can sound like it takes up a lot of time, which is what was worrying a lot of people. But in the end, it happened very quickly. The bill was passed, and with much better language than the original amendment, I think. And a separate credit is due to Gary Glass, who I touched base with him afterwards and said he'd been sort of trading emails and voicemails with Representative Johnson throughout the process. And I think that we do have the American Homebrewers Association to thank for staying involved throughout the process to make sure that the final language of the bill was really a compromise, you know, from all parties concerned, but all the compromises were done in a responsible fashion so that it didn't unduly hinder, you know, transportation and brewing competitions in the state of Utah.
So what are the restrictions that are placed on transporting homebrew?
Well, what they've done is you can – initially the original amendment said this was per calendar year, which is one of the things that they changed, because it says that you can remove 72 ounces per adult from the home for personal use or consumption, or for personal use or consumption at a homebrew festival, and you can, and that's at any given time. There's no, you know, cumulative, you know, time frame around. Just at any point, you know, if you were pulled over by the police officers or something else, you'd, as long as you had, you know, 72 ounces per adult in the car, you'd be covered. In addition to that, you're actually allowed to have up to 72 ounces for a submission to a competition, and that amount, as I understand it, is multiplied for up to three category submissions.
Ah.
And so you can make multiple submissions to a homebrew competition and still have some, you know, on your own for consumption purposes. And that's all with respect to beer. I think that the blanket amount is 1 liter for wine. That's the amendment.
So essentially, if you want to take a corny keg somewhere, you have to get a bus full of people. And
That would be the prevailing logic, I think. Just get a whole mess of people together, and as long as you can all lay claim to 72 ounces of homebrew.
Well, it's kind of hard to complain. You know, it's kind of looking a gift horse in the mouth to complain about the new legality. It's a giant step forward, and we can't dwell on the picky stuff at this point, in my opinion. The law is passed, but homebrewing is not technically legal yet, right?
Not quite yet. In fact, what happens is once both chambers approve it, it has to go to the Speaker of the House and the Senate President. They sign it. They send it over to Legislative Council, who rolls the bill. Not entirely sure where the source of that word is, but they roll the bill essentially, and then they send it over to the governor's office for signature. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but we've got a pretty reasonable governor, John Huntsman Jr. He has been pushing for a lot of various alcohol reform in the state to try and make it more tourist friendly and make the rules less, you know, peculiar to tourists and visitors. And so I have no reason to believe this won't be a friendly bill for him. But even then, once he signs it, there's a standard rule, and I had to double check this on the Utah legislature's website. But what happens is once a bill is passed, it goes into effect. All bills, all new legislation go into effect on a standard that date falls 60 days after the adjournment of the legislative session. And so this year, after the session expires and the 60 days are told, the effective date for new legislation is May 12th. And that will be the day that homebrewers get to celebrate the legalization of homebrewing in Utah, which, as I've said before, is a much better day to celebrate by brewing than in February. So in the end, I think it'll be more welcome brewing weather in the middle of May.
Well, I hope that you guys have a big blowout in May and, you know, do something in a public fashion. And we would certainly love to come over and cover that.
Oh, absolutely. Mark your calendar, because I know I'm having people over on May 12th. There's going to be a homebrew festival here. And I know that Mark and Jamie over at the Beer Nut have been talking about putting together Utah's first homebrew competition. We'll see how fast they can put that together. I mean, people are really excited, and they've got a lot to be excited about. And I'll note, speaking of being excited, this is worth noting. Of the last two or three senators that didn't vote in favor of the bill, one of them was a Republican named Gregory Bell, if I recall. And his quote in the newspaper was, you know, when asked why he didn't vote in favor of the bill, he says, "Maybe I just don't understand it, but to me it seems fraught with mischief." Right? So it's a great quote, and for two reasons. One, because he obviously was one of the few senators we didn't get to. I mean, he wasn't on any of the committees and wasn't really a part of any of the good debates. And I think that that goes to the core of why any state has trouble legalizing the hobby, because frankly, it's really just about educating people. Once people understand that it really is not moonshine and this is about a responsible hobby, people's minds can be changed. And we saw that repeatedly, you know, over the last couple of terms. But more importantly, the fraught with mischief phrase has been swiftly adopted as the motto of all Utah homebrewers. And so expect to see that. The Beer Nut's already got it on their marquee in front of the store. It'll probably show up on bumper stickers and T-shirts before too long. Utah homebrewers, fraught with mischief.
So. And tattoos as well.
Indeed.
Well, Douglas, congratulations again.
Thank you, James.
And we are interested to see what your next conquest will be.
I'll keep you posted for sure.
Thanks, Douglas.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Douglas, and congratulations to all homebrewers in Utah. One last note, Douglas says that no money had to be raised in this effort, so you can still do a lot with grassroots support. Tune in to Douglas's podcast, Homebrewing Perspectives, for lots more detail. He says he's working up a kind of a clip show with clips from the debate and such as that. So it should be very, very interesting. I'm looking forward to that. Moving right along, I'm hurrying this week to fit everything in. Mike Lozano has walked us through the process of making mead in previous episodes, but he joins us this week to tell us an easy way to make a mead cousin, piments. Mike Lozano, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Seems like just last week, James.
It was 2 weeks ago, wasn't it?
2 weeks, yeah. Time flies when work is busy.
Well, I appreciate your taking time and coming back. And we're talking about a sort of a new animal. It's not a beer. It's not a wine, and it's not really a mead, is it?
No, it's a hybrid. So one of those wonderful hybrids that people who get bored doing one thing for too long dream up when they're sitting around going, well, what if I combine these two things? And, of course, we're talking about piments.
Piments. Piments. We've talked about lots of different ways you can use honey to make beverages. And if you mix grapes or grape juice and honey and then ferment that, that is a piment, and that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about a little bit of a shortcut, rather than going out and picking out your own grapes and smashing them with your feet and all that. You found a way to make a piment in an easier way.
Yeah, because I tend to be lazy, and if there's a better, quicker way to do it, I'm all for that. As long as the quality of the end product comes out fine.
I'm all for
that. So as you said, when I was first researching this, and piments are a really old drink. We weren't the first ones to think of it, as much as I'd like to take credit, but it's an ancient take. So if you hang around David Myers long enough, he will tell you that mead is arguably the oldest beverage on the planet. And as honey became more and more scarce, people started augmenting the fermentable sugar in honey with other fermentables such as malt and grape juice. So by his assertion, then these hybrids, which would be a braggot in the case of malt or a piment in the case of grape juice, actually predated beer and wine. So it's been around for quite a while.
But you don't see very many commercial piments out there.
You don't. Redstone has two. They have a red and a white, but it's not a common beverage at all. Interestingly enough, but I think they're great. I love the red piments, and the first time I did this, it came out really, really well. And now I'm making them. It's one of the one regular brews that I do every year.
So describe the character of a piment. How does it differ from wine, and how does it differ from mead?
So a piment is actually going to be much closer to what you expect from a wine than a mead. And that's basically because the character of the grape juice is going to be in the forefront. The honey adds additional complexity to that. And the way I like to do it, it actually adds sweetness. So up to now, my first two piment batches have been with Pinot Noir grapes. You know, Pinot Noir wine is a kind of a softer kind of red. But still has, you know, some body to it. And then by adding the honey, and I've used orange blossom honey, you get additional aromatics, you get additional body, you get additional flavor, and then I left it a little sweet. So you get this nice, rich, aromatic, sweet red. It's really, really hard to put it into words without actually tasting it.
So let's get started talking about how you make these things. So you start off, and again, we said that you kind of cheat a little bit.
Yes. So I was saying, that when I started researching this, most of the really serious home brewers like to go out and research local wineries and pick some grape juice and then do all this analysis and whatnot. And I thought, that's just way too much work. And then I kept talking to myself, you know, they sell wine kits down at the local homebrew shop. Why in the world should I be doing all this hard work when the wine kit people have done this for me?
Yeah, there are big bags of juices just waiting there for you.
Yeah, big bags of juices and guaranteed quality and all this kind of good stuff. So I said, hey, let me try to do something with this. So I started doing some research. I picked out a kit. The biggest decision that I had to make was I going to use a lower-end kit or a higher-end kit. And everybody that I talked to about wine kits says that, you know, the quality of the kit really is going to determine the quality of the wine that you get out of it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I'll get, you know, kind of a higher-end kit and start there. And when I told the guys down at the local homebrew store that I was going to take this kit and make a piment out of it, I raised a few eyebrows over there. They thought I was nuts.
And this is the Brew Hut. We've got to give them a little plug.
Yeah. So this is the Brew Hut. And my good friend Steve down there and all the guys down there. But, you know, they actually tasted the finished product, and I've heard no complaints since. So, like I said, it's good stuff. So, you know, I didn't want to use the entire kit for Pyman. I actually wanted to, you know, have the experience of making the wine as well. Then it also gives an opportunity to compare and contrast the finished wine product with the finished Pyman product. So you can actually tell how the honey affects the wine.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I came up with this method. There's a little math involved. And basically what I do is I take the kit and put it together and then put half the wine into one carboy and then add honey and water to the other carboy and make that into a pyment. And it works out extraordinarily well.
So you wind up with a smaller batch of wine and a normal size batch of pyment.
That's right. Exactly. Because the way I see it, the piment's going to go faster than the wine anyway.
Hmm.
It's going to be consumed quicker.
So how did it work out? I mean, what are the things that you've got to look for when you're doing something like this that's different from making a mead and different from making just a standard wine kit?
So it's actually, as I discovered, easier than making a mead.
Ah.
And that is because, best I can tell from the results, there's strong evidence to suggest that the juice is treated by the wine kit company with pH balancers and nutrients at the factory.
Huh.
So that stuff you don't have to worry about. On the other side, there's more handling prior to yeast pitch than with the mead and with the wine kit itself. There's extra steps, and you have to do math.
Ooh.
Yes, there's math involved. And you have to do math after the water and juice has been mixed, which means you have to do it quickly to try to stave off, you know, any possible infections.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into that in the process. But it is something that you need to be, you know, you want to be prepared before you mix the stuff up. Have your calculator ready and have the spreadsheet we'll talk about ready so that you can do these calculations so you know how much you're going to need to add.
So what kind of gear are we going to need? Is there anything that we don't have as brewers or mead makers that we'll need to make this pyment?
Actually, no. There's one auxiliary piece that I would suggest you have, and I've suggested that before. But for the most part, if you have been brewing beer or if you've been brewing wine, even better, chances are you have everything that you need. Since we're doing basically two batches at once, you're going to need to plan for that. This can't all be done with just two carboys. You have to have at least three carboys to do this because you have to have somewhere to rack.
Mm.
So you need at least three carboys. But after that, it's pretty straightforward.
Now, do you need a smaller carboy than usual for the wine? Since it's half a batch of wine, do you have to worry about the extra headspace?
Yeah. So what I do is I start out the batch in a really big pail. I have a 7.9 gallon pail. And that's where I mix the initial 6 gallons, you know, what becomes the 6 gallons of the wine juice. I then siphon off 3 gallons of that into a 5 gallon carboy for the wine. And I will ferment the wine in the 5 gallon as a primary. I then use the 7.9 to mix the water and the honey for the 5 gallon batch of pyment. That gives me a lot of space. I can use my, you know, gas whip to do the mixing, and I run a lot less risk of splashing over the edge of the pail. So what I suggest for this is a 7.9-gallon pail, a 5-gallon carboy, and then a 3-gallon carboy as well. So what you'll be doing is that as the fermentation for both batches reaches near the end, you'll be racking the 5-gallon wine into the 3-gallon carboy. Mm. You will then do a really quick cleaning of the 5-gallon carboy, and then you will rack the 5 gallons of Pyman back into the 3-gallon carboy, and that's where, and they'll serve as secondaries.
Or the Pyman goes into the 5-gallon carboy.
Right, and since all that was in there was red wine, you know, it's red wine anyway. So not as big a deal. But I still clean it out beforehand, of course.
So that's a little bit of a dance there, a little bit of a you know, do-si-do, but it saves having 4 carboys. You only have 3.
Sure, and if you've got an extra 5 gallon that's empty and clean, you can certainly just, you know, rack it into the other 5. It's no big deal, but at a minimum, you'll need those 3 carboys.
So we'll need, in addition to the 3 carboys, we'll need the degasser whip, which we talked about in the mead thing.
Yeah, it's my favorite friend. It's a good way of getting cold water and cold honey to mix together without having to heat it up or anything like that. It's fantastic. It's my favorite piece of gear nowadays. So that's all. You know, it's not necessary. You can still do it with a paddle if you really wanted to. But like I said, I'm lazy and I just like the noise. You know?
Yeah, and I can tell you, the battery ran out on my portable drill, and I had to degas a wine by hand. Not a lot of fun.
No.
Go through the rest of your equipment list here. Your hardware, as you say.
Right. So obviously you're going to want some way of oxygen. I'll have an oxygen stone, but any kind of oxygen method that you're used to using is fine. But you will need to put oxygen into your batch. The other thing that you're absolutely not going to have is a gram scale, and you're going to need a gram scale that goes down to at least tenths of a gram. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why you need that is because the method that you use for the Pyman is going to be exactly the same as the method that you use for the wine, but they only give you, with the wine kit, enough for a 6-gallon batch of wine. So you're going to need to add additional components, that being the potassium metabisulfate and the potassium sorbate, to the brew, and the total amount is going to be, you're going to need about 25% more if you do the math, because you know you're doing a total of 8 gallons, I mean, for the 5-gallon Pyman and 3-gallon wine, and they only gave you enough for 6 gallons. So you're going to need 33% more.
Mm-hmm.
My math is off. 33% more of both. So what you do is that when you get the kits that I have actually have the amount of grams of the components on the outside of the packet. And then you just do the math, and then you have to measure out the additional amounts that you'll need with a gram scale. So you will need a gram scale, not something you want to try to, you know, guess. That's, you know, I tend to be a little exacting on that. So it's highly recommended that you have a gram scale.
Now, you say the one thing that is not needed is a pH meter.
Yeah, and that's something that I learned. The juice seems to be treated. In both cases, when I did these, I took pH readings for the batches, and neither batches ever got down to dangerous levels of pH. So you can literally just, you know, pitch yeast in the proper manner and just let them go until they get down to the proper gravity. So, you know, I would say that if you're going to do something other than red, if you're going to do a white, or if you want to have the experience just the first time out, you can double check, but chances are you won't need your pH meter.
Cool. Now, on the software side, as you say, of course, we're going to need a wine kit.
And get the highest quality one that you can afford. You can do that with practically any wine kit, but the higher quality kits will give you a better result.
That makes sense. And we'll need honey. And again, high quality honey will give you a better quality product.
Right. And you definitely want to be careful with honeys here. As we learned in our honey experiment, not all honeys give a good characteristic to a batch. So I would stick with a lighter honey that you know tastes good and tastes good in a mead. You don't want bitter characteristics. You know, if you're going to do a white Pyman, you definitely don't want to overwhelm your delicate white wine with a really nasty, bitter-type honey mm-hmm. in the batch. So be cognizant of that. I've had really, really good experience with the orange blossom honey with these piments. I'm looking now at the sage honey, and I'll probably end up sticking with those two. So you know, it's more about, you know, the marrying of the two, you know, the two, the wine and the honey, or the grape juice and the honey, than it is about making it taste like the honey alone.
Mm-hmm. So you say that we'll need to calculate how much honey to put in there, but is there a range that is safe to assume? In other words, how much is the high end of how much honey that we're going to need to purchase to make sure that we have enough for the batch?
So, of course, the correct answer to that is it depends. But generally, what I've done with my batches has been right around 9 pounds of honey.
Wow.
And that's about 3/4 of a gallon. And we'll get into that when we get into the math. But around nine gallons, and that's because I like my pimates a little higher end on the alcohol. Certainly, again, when your calculations come out, if you don't want your starting gravity that high, or don't you want your ABV to be that high, if you want to be closer to 12 or 10, right, you'll just use less honey, use more water. So it just all depends.
So if you have 9 pounds of honey on hand, you'll be in good shape.
Be in good shape, absolutely. And for a mead maker, having 9 pounds of honey around is not uncommon, because typically we buy in the gallon anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And water, any special water preparations?
Any water that you've got experience that comes out good with making good wine in the wine kit works fine. Again, the standard things apply. You can use bottled water from the store. If your water tastes great, fine. If your water needs to be unchlorinated overnight, again, great. Nothing really special that you have to worry about here. Thank goodness.
Now, yeast, a packet of yeast will come with the wine kit. So we'll need another one of those, right?
Right. And I typically, with the gravities that I work at, I end up doing 2 packets for the mead, just because it's a higher gravity. And that's just to be safe. I've made both of my red wine batches with RC212. It's not always what comes with the kit. I've seen a lot of the red wine kits come with the EC1118, but whatever comes with the kit, use for the wine, and then pick your own yeast for the piment. Again, with my reds, I use RC212. That's a Lavalin yeast.
Now, do you have to worry about over-pitching the wine since it's half a batch, or do you just put the whole packet in there?
I just put the whole packet in. In fact, the instructions have you just tear it open the pack and sprinkle it right onto the juice.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, that works just fine.
Yeah.
Now, with my batches, since I want them to ferment and try to get down to their target gravities as quickly as possible, I want my wine to finish before my piment, because I need to get that out of the 5 gallon and into the 3 before I can get my piment out of the pail and into the 5 that the wine was in. So I will properly prep my dry yeast with GoFirm and put it in first, and to make sure that it has a healthy start and doesn't get behind the piment.
Mm. Makes sense. And then we will need sorbate and K-Meta.
Right. So the kit comes with that. It's a stabilizer, and I do use a stabilizer on these piments. You'll just need a little bit of extra, as we hinted at before, to ensure that you have enough for the piment so that the piment doesn't renew fermentation later. So you need a little extra of each of those.
And tell us a bit more about that, because, I mean, if someone is listening and they've done beers but they haven't done a wine kit, they haven't used this stuff before, so go into just a little more detail on that.
Right. So the sorbate is meant to keep yeast from budding. The metabisulfate is really meant to kill off the yeast. But what they found is that using the two together in smaller amounts, actually they work off each other and are very, very effective. So it keeps you from having to over-sorbate or use too much K-Meta, but still get a fantastic result. So the idea there is that once you reach your target gravity, you're killing off all the yeast activity and ensuring that not only does the gravity stabilize, but that it doesn't magically restart later.
And we're protecting against infection.
Exactly. The potassium, actually, some kits have an extra package of potassium metabisulfate to sanitize beforehand.
Hmm.
So it is a method of stabilizing and saving off infection and all that wonderful goodness.
So there are, as in the hardware, in the software, there are things that are not needed.
Right. So if you've heard the Meat Show, you know that proper pH balance and a nutrient schedule are key to getting a strong, quick fermentation without overstressing your yeast. The evidence here suggests that those two components have already been added into the juice. So similar to the fact that you would never add nutrients to a braggot, because I've got an explosive fermentation with a braggot without having to breathe hard. The same thing apparently is true also with the way that the wine juice comes from these wine kits. And I was ready the first time I did this. I was right there ready with the nutrients and whatnot. If the fermentation ever slowed or got stuck halfway down. But it dropped like a rock. It was fantastic. I didn't have to do anything at all. So set your nutrients and your potassium carbonate aside. You won't need them.
And what about finings?
The kit actually comes with this kit that I got now. It comes with a liquid chitosan finding agent. So what I'll do is I'll weigh it, pour it out, weigh it again, and when I get about halfway down on the wine, I'll save the rest for the piment. Oh, and even though I'm using a, you know, a 3 gallons worth of this finding agent for a 5 gallon piment, you got to remember you're only using half of the wine kit there so much. And usually the honey that I have clears on its own. It's always been enough.
Huh. So you can save some money there.
Save some money there. Absolutely.
All right.
That's really the end of the software. I mean, it's standard stuff. Standard stuff you should have lying around, except for maybe the K-meta and the sorbate, the potassium sorbate, potassium carbonate, metabisulfate, sorry. And you might have that around if you've ever done any kind of wine stabilizing or meat stabilizing.
So basically, I mean, I'm looking at the list, and other than those ingredients, about the only thing that I don't have is a 3 gallon carboy. But, I probably need to get one of those anyway.
To ensure that you don't have a lot of headspace in your carboy when it goes into the secondary to help stave off oxidation.
There you go. So get us started. We got all our gear. We got all our ingredients. Now what do we do?
Right. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to follow the wine kit instructions exactly as they come with the kit. There's really not a whole lot of thing to worry about here. If you've made a wine kit, this is going to be very easy. Where you stop is before you add the yeast or any oak chips or oak dust that come with the kit. So once you've mixed it up, you've got to your 6 gallons, you're right there ready to stop to pitch those two things, you stop. Now what you then need to do is siphon off half of the wine into the 5 gallon carboy. So you just get your racking cane and siphon it off into there. Since the bucket that I have actually has markings for U.S. gallons on the side. I just use that as a guide. I don't get overly concerned with that. And I just siphon it off until it says that 3 gallons are gone, and I stop. Now, for the wine side of things, you, again, start right back to where it was. You know, if you've got two packages of oak, you toss one packet into the wine. You toss in the yeast that came with the kit, put on the airlock, and you're off. And that's really all you have to do with the wine. Now, the piment, though, it's now time to do math. The clock is ticking. The first thing you need to do is you have to take a gravity reading of the wine juice. And of course, the kit has you check this anyway, so you're going to have that reading regardless of the process. You'll have the reading. And since you're in a pail, you can just sanitize your hydrometer, drop it into the pail, and get a really good accurate reading. The next thing you need to do is you need to visit the website. And, of course, you want to visit this before you start and have this ready. You visit the website called High Tests Honey Haven, and we'll put a link for that up at the website. And on that website, there is a link for the Honey Calculator spreadsheet. This honey calculator spreadsheet is fantastic because what it does is that it has a little area where you can put in values for honey, for water, and for juice.
Hmm.
So what you're going to do is that whatever gravity reading, say your gravity reading came out to 1085, okay? So 1.085. You put that into the specific gravity column for the juice. You then, in the volume column, which is done in cups, you'll put in 48 cups for 3 gallons. And you'll look over in the gallons column, and when you put in 48, it'll translate that out into 3 gallons. Now, what you have to do then is that you have to add values for honey and for water. And at the bottom, what you're looking for is a total volume of 5 gallons. And then you're going to watch the original gravity at the bottom of the little table there. So if I put in with 1085 at 3 gallons, and if I put in 9 pounds of honey, and then I put in 20 cups of water, which is a gallon and a quarter, what I get is 5.01 gallons of total volume, and I get an original gravity of 1.114. Now, what I shoot for is roughly 1.110 to 1.120, and that's about halfway through there, so that's fantastic. So what I would then do is measure out 9 pounds of honey, pour it in, I put in a gallon of water, and I take a reading. Now, it should be higher than 1.114, but you don't know if you've got exactly 3 gallons of there or not, so you want to start measuring there. So it's still too high, add a cup, mix really well with the wine whip, take another reading, and you keep doing that until you hit where you want to start, and then you're done.
This is where it'd be really handy to have a refractometer, right?
You could do the refractometer, or since you're using a pail, I just drop the old hydrometer right into the batch.
No, that's true.
The advantage of using a pail in this particular instance.
Right.
But either way works. If you're a hydrometer junkie or a refractometer junkie, have at it. Either way works. But you need to make sure that you mix well, because if your honey is sitting at the bottom of your brew, then your readings are going to be lower, and then when it actually finally gets all mixed in, the gravity is going to be much higher than you thought. So you need to mix really well. It's where the gas whip comes in very, very handy. So that is the first piece of math that you have to do. That's the hardest part of this whole thing, is just figuring out how much honey and how much water you have to add to get the gravity up to where you want it. Now, with the same calculator, you can put in what your target final gravity is going to be. I like mine a little sweeter. I put my target gravity at 1015. So with a starting gravity of 1114 and a final gravity of 1015, I end up with an estimated alcohol by volume of 13.1, which is great. That's fantastic. If you want your stronger, you actually put in more honey and less water, again, until you get to about 5 gallons, and then you'll see that your gravity will go up. If you don't want it as high, you put in more water and less honey. You get that, again, try to balance it out to 5 gallons, and it'll tell you what your alcohol by volume will be as well.
Huh.
Now, if you've made a wine kit before, you'll know that the wine kit has you put in the potassium sorbate and the potassium metabisulfate once you hit a certain target final gravity. Now, in this kit, it just so happens that gravity is like 0.996, which, of course, is dry.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously want to pitch well before then. So you want to pitch when it hits 1015 instead. You'll also want to pitch or to rack about 15 points earlier as well. So they'll have you rack at about 1.005 or something like that. Instead, you'll want to rack at 1020. You want to rack earlier because there's certain things that happen. You want to get most of the yeast out, but you still want it to ferment. Just like the kit goes, you just need to be cognizant of, oh, my final gravity is actually going to be higher. I need to do some of these processes sooner.
So you're racking before you hit the final gravity that you want.
Correct. Adjusted against the numbers that the kit says. Correct.
So,
in fact, let me look at the kit here. This says, secondary fermentation. Check that your specific gravity, it should be 1010 or less. So the target for racking is 1010, which is about 14 points before your target final gravity for the wine. So that's about a 15-point spread. Yours is going to be 20 points higher than that. So you would actually be racking at 1030.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at here?
The time frame actually works very, very lock and step with the wine kit. So your 10-10 gravity is going to be hit in about 5 to 7 days.
Hmm.
With the wine, and you can get to 10-30 with this piment with two packs of yeast in the same amount of time, 5 to 7 days.
So that's something that you want to keep your eye on.
Oh, certainly. Oh, certainly.
Because if you go too dry, I guess you could sweeten it back up, but you don't want to go too far.
Yeah, and of course, by then, it's too late. The alcohol is higher than you wanted it. So that's the downside. It'll be more alcoholic than you want. It's definitely something you want to check the gravity every day on these things. Absolutely. It's not so bad with the wine because you're going to be fermenting the wine dry. So right. It's not as big of a deal, but with the piment, you want to stop it while it's still sweet, so you do have to watch it more carefully.
So you're watching carefully. Your wine hits its target gravity for racking. You rack it from the 5 gallon into the 3 gallon. You clean out your 5 gallon, and your piment is ready, and you rack it into the 5 gallon.
Yep.
And then it's just a waiting game, checking in the gravities again until you reach your desired sweetness or your desired final gravity?
That's correct. Now, you have to be careful here because with the wine, you can be lazy. You can let the wine sit for 7 days and just let it until it reaches final gravity. You don't care when it did. It's just going to hit it.
Right.
You have to watch your piment because your piment will pass that line. So, again, you're checking gravity daily. Once it gets to your target final gravity, which now you're using the whole wine thief with the hydrometer trick to check the gravity. Once you hit it, then you start into what is called stabilizing and clearing. Okay, so stabilizing and clearing is when you add in the potassium sorbate, the potassium metabisulfate, and the finding agents, right? And you do that exactly as the kit says for the wine. And you'll just do it twice, once for the wine, once for the piment. And you just follow the kit instructions as if it was just another wine.
Now, the only difference here is that you've, again, got to do math because you've got to calculate half of what you would normally use in those stabilizing agents and use that on the wine. And then you've got to calculate up to figure out how much finding agents the stabilizers that you're going to use for the larger volume piment, right?
That's correct. So for the wine kit, for the wine side, you're using half of what came with the kit. So the potassium, for example, the potassium metabisulfate for this one is 4 grams. So you're going to measure out 2 grams and use it for the honey. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the wine. And then that's 3 gallons worth. Now, you have to use 5 gallons worth for the piment. So if 3 gallons worth was 2 grams, then 5 gallons worth is going to be about 3 1/3 grams. So you'll have to actually have an additional 1.3 grams of potassium metabisulfate to add in.
Now, what if you go over? What if you just put 4 instead of 3 1/3?
So if you do 3 1/3, is it going to kill anything? No. I like to be exact just because I'm that way. there are some folks that say if you put too many of these additives in, that you can actually taste it in the final brew.
Mm.
So I tend to try to be very exacting and use just the minimal amounts as necessary. Now for the potassium sorbate for this kit, there's 5.5 grams. So you would use 2.75 grams for the wine. And then if you do the math here, you would use about 4.5 grams for the piment.
Cool. And again, you said for the finding agents, you just chop those in half and call that good.
Yeah, it all works. Now the reason why the chemicals are more important because you're doing your stabilizing agents based on the mass of yeast, which is more yeast for more volume. So you're doing that by volume. But what you're really clearing out for the clarifying agents is the yeast itself, but also anything that came in over with the juice. And for some reason, because you're using a higher proportion of water and the honey seems to clear on its own, you're just using the three gallons worth of the fining agent for the 5 gallon of Pymet works every time.
Hmm. So once those are in, it's just a waiting game until the wine and the Pymet clears, right?
Yeah, the kit says to wait for 8 days. That's fine. At this point, everything's stabilized. As long as you've got liquid in your airlocks, everything should be fine. Just let it sit until it's absolutely clear. You can use a wine thief to pull some out, put it in a wine glass, take a look at it in the light, see if it's cleared up. And then you just rack to your bottling bucket and bottle. And you've got a nice Pymet and a wine to match.
So how long could you sit on the secondary safely, you say?
I've actually let a kit go for 2 weeks like that because I had to travel, and mm-hmm. it was fine. I wouldn't let it sit for too much longer than that because, again, it's sitting on the chemicals, the additives that you put in there, the fining agents, and the yeast. If you've got a delicate enough wine, especially a lighter white wine, it could incur some taste characteristics into the final product. So don't let it sit for too long, but it's not gonna kill anything if it sits there for an extra week. It's not that big of a deal.
So were you surprised the first time that you did this, the difference between the Pymet and the wine that came from the same juice?
Oh, I was shocked. I was shocked. It was sweet, but it wasn't cloyingly sweet. It was that extra body sweetness, and it complemented the wine so well that when I first drank it, you couldn't tell that that wasn't what it was supposed to taste like.
Huh.
Right? It honestly felt like it, that this was just another sweeter version of the wine, and that's how this new product was supposed to taste. I was utterly shocked at how well it came out. But you can still taste the similarities between the two. It's very easy to taste the similarities between the wine and the Pymet. But the Pymet just has that extra kick of sweetness, the extra complexity and aroma from the honey. You can pick it out as well. It was just, I was tickled pink with the way that came out.
And I can testify, and as well as Andy and Steve, you sent a bottle of each, a bottle of red, a bottle of white, as Billy Joel would say, of the Pymets with the last tasting that we had here, and they're delicious. So the proof of the Pymet is in the tasting. They're very good.
Yep, and for not having to go out and track down honey and do all these nutrient calculations on top of everything else, it's a very, very easy way to make a very, very tasty product.
Well, very good. Any last tips that you can think of that we haven't talked about?
Study the calculator ahead of time. Don't try to learn how to use this thing after you've mixed up your wine. Download it. It works in Microsoft Excel. It also works in OpenOffice, if you're using OpenOffice. Play with the numbers. Look at the wine kit that you have, and the wine kit will tell you where your target gravity should be once you've mixed up the juice. So you can actually do some calculations ahead of time to get in the ballpark of how much honey that you're going to buy based on the gravity that you want, so that you're not caught off guard and saying, "Oh, I've got to go buy honey," but no, my water's already mixed and my I've got to pitch yeast. So do a few of those calculations up front. Once you get the hang of the calculator, it's not that hard, thankfully. But definitely don't try to learn the calculator and do this cold turkey as you're sitting there having already mixed your wine juice and water.
Very good.
That's the biggest. Everything after that is just a lot of math, and typical gravity readings.
But again, a lot of that can be done ahead of time, so that you're not doing it while your hands are wet with sanitizer. And
absolutely. And this is a little personal thing of mine. I used to bottle all of my wines and whatnot in wine bottles. I've gotten past that now. Beer bottles work fine. They're not as romantic, but they're a heck of a lot cheaper.
And
so don't be afraid to bottle your wine and your Pymet into beer bottles. Don't let people give you a hard time about that.
And another advantage is that a beer bottle is only 12 ounces. So that, there's a practical aspect of it. You know, you don't feel like you have to finish off a whole, bottle of wine – You can just bring out a smaller serving.
And it seems to last longer that way. If you've, you know, having two 12-ounce bottles rather than one 750 milliliter, it tends to last longer for some odd reason.
Well, excellent. You've done it again, Mike. I appreciate your help.
It's my pleasure being on the show, and I'm just glad I can share this wonderful little method that I found with the basic brewing community.
Excellent. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Mike. I can testify that is tasty stuff. I'll post a link to the calculator that Mike talked about in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. Remember, we've got the Brewer's Logbook and our new Basic Winemaking Introduction to Wine Kits DVD out there on our online store. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewingshop.com. You can also check out our original DVDs, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, and Stepping into All Grain. And we got combo deals if you want to save a couple of bucks. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it from us online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We got shirts and, as usual, thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Story's Guide to Raising Chickens, The Care, Feeding, and Facilities, and Lewis Carroll, The Complete, Fully Illustrated Works, Deluxe Edition. Very cool. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on the site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson, our buddy in Austin. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.